So I did all of this while I was pregnant with our third. I sold the book at 7 months pregnant, and that was really an empowering thing to sell a book while that pregnant with my third.
Welcome back to another episode of Influencer Business. I'm your host, Rich Scudelari. We hope you're doing well. We hope you're staying safe. And we certainly are excited to have you with us here today. We have an amazing interview lined up for you. We're sitting down to chat with Elizabeth Holmes, the creator of the Instagram Stories phenomenon, So Many Thoughts, SMT as you may know it. Elizabeth is not a traditional influencer necessarily. She's actually spent over a decade at the Wall Street Journal and has a long career as a journalist. But she's found an exciting and a very excited audience with her commentary on royal style, and it manifests itself in Instagram stories, and it has actually led to a wonderful book deal. The book is actually coming out in November, but you can pre-order it now. We highly recommend that you do so because, as you will hear in our interview, Elizabeth has spent a tremendous amount of time and effort to make this a very special book. So more on that to come. We're going to talk to Elizabeth about her career as a journalist, how she transitioned into commentary on royal style, and what it was like to develop and sell that book to a publisher. All of that to come. But first, a big shout out to our sponsor, ShopStyle, who is our partner in this podcast. They are an awesome group of people. If you're not already familiar with ShopStyle, head over to ShopStyleCollective.com. They're your resource for influencer marketing. Whether you're an influencer looking to monetize or grow your business, they have the tools and the team that can help you do that. If you're a brand or a retailer or a marketer who's looking to do a better job on your influencer marketing or have a good partner on your influencer marketing campaigns, ShopStyle is the team to do it. They do everything for everyone. So make sure you head over to ShopStyleCollective.com. And also, if you like what you hear on the podcast today, please leave us that 5-star rating. Give us that glowing review. It really does help. And it makes us feel better about ourselves. So, you know, if you're looking to put out some good vibes today, do that for us. We really appreciate it. But with that out of the way, let's get to our interview with Elizabeth. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us today on Influencer Business.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Before we get into SMT, which is going to be the bulk of this conversation, obviously, can you share a little bit with our audience about your journey as a journalist?
Oh, absolutely. So I got the bug for journalism back in college. I was the editor-in-chief of my college paper and very much wanted to make a go at it in newspapers and was not able to do that. So my first thing is, I always like to tell people when I'm, you know, sort of doling out career advice is that you kind of can take a little bit of a winding path to where you want to go. I was not able to get an internship in college in newspapers, but I was able to get an internship in television. I'm from outside of Chicago. I interned at a TV station there and then got the bug for television journalism, decided after college that I wanted to go into television journalism and move to the middle of nowhere, Michigan, where I was an on-air reporter for a hot second. TV 6 News Escanaba. It was a fun little moment in my early 20s. And then my life lesson there is just to say that you can learn pretty quickly what you like and don't like. And I did not like television news. I learned it wasn't for me. I missed writing. So I went back to graduate school. I went to Columbia and moved to New York. And that was just sort of a door into a whole new world for me. I fell in love with New York City and made a ton of wonderful contacts at different national news outlets. After graduation there, I interviewed at a bunch of places and got a lot of very polite requests to go get more experience. So I moved back home to Chicago and I got a job at a newspaper, a suburban Chicago newspaper. And I wrote my fingers off. I wrote 3 stories a day on some days and just covered whatever I could in terms of local news, all kinds of different sort of hyper local stories. But it was a great introduction to journalism. And after about 2 years there, I reached back out to my mentor, who's a longtime writer for the Wall Street Journal. And she said, "What are you doing? What are you up to?" And I was like, "I'm, you know, covering school assemblies and the crime beat out here in the Midwest." And she was like, "I think I can get you another interview at the Wall Street Journal." I flew to New York and I met with some folks and I said, "I'll do anything. I will pour coffee. I will, you know, like whatever you need me to do." This was back in 2006 and they hired me. And it was thrilling to move from a sort of small suburban newspaper to one of, you know, the biggest newspapers in the country, to move back to New York to sort of dive in there. And the Wall Street Journal was my home for more than a decade. I did so many wonderful things there. I'm forever grateful to the paper. It was an incredible learning experience, and I covered all kinds of different things, everything from sort of small business to the 2008 presidential campaign, which feels like a lifetime ago. I was on the campaign trail for 14 months, living out of a suitcase and following first Barack Obama and then John McCain and Sarah Palin around the country, which was fascinating. From there, I moved to the retail beat at the Journal. It's funny because people ask me how I got into style reporting, and it wasn't really my choice, if I'm being totally honest. It was after the presidential campaign. It was 2009. We were sort of in an economic freefall, and the retail desk said, you know, hey, would you like to come cover retail? It's a really important time for retailers. There's, you know, people, discretionary spending had dried up, and they were like, we need some help over here. And I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I like shopping, but like, I've never thought of myself as like a retail reporter. And they're like, we're not asking. And I was like, oh, great. I would absolutely love to come and cover retail.
That would be amazing.
That sounds great for me. So I moved to our corporate desk then, and my introduction to the world of style reporting was through retail. I mean, through very much a Wall Street Journal business lens of earnings reports and supply chains and executive appointments and things like that. And I actually think it was a wonderful way to understand the kind of the inner workings of these companies and branding and marketing and messaging. And I loved it. But the daily news grind really takes its toll. And so when, I guess this was back in 2011, I had a chance to kind of graduate to the feature desk, I took it excitedly, and then became sort of more of a true style reporter where I wrote longer features and had a chance to kind of get to know and source up on, you know, really wonderful fashion personalities and go to Fashion Week and do all that fun stuff on top of it. So I was at the Wall Street Journal from 2006 through early 2017.
Wow. And can you tell us a little bit about the dichotomy there, the difference between the kind of daily grind and feature reporting, and how you think about your deliverables, what matters in terms of your production and things like that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the Journal, it was a really wonderful place to work because it sort of, on the feature desk especially, it gave us time to sort of let a story breathe, you know, to like, I had a column before I left. And so I had one story like every other week, which is a really leisurely pace for a journalist these days. But it was great because it let me become an authority on whatever I was writing about for that topic. It let me really kind of understand and, you know, make two dozen calls on something. Whereas when you're on a breaking news story and you need to churn out a lot of content as quickly as possible, you know, you try and get your answers from as few as people as possible and write the story as quickly as possible and publish it soon.
Yeah.
So I prefer, as a journalist, a chance to sit with something for a little bit longer. But that's a real luxury. I think both skills are really important. But yeah, feature reporting is definitely my preferred course right now.
Sure. And how does a paper like the Wall Street Journal balance the two? Because you're attracting a slightly, you know, maybe you're attracting a different customer, but in the context of the business side of things, how do they balance the kind of breaking news versus that longer featured editorial stuff?
It's interesting because I think there's a readership for both. I think scoops and, you know, exclusives and that kind of breaking news really drives a lot of the news business these days, especially in an age of social media. But I do think there's something about customer loyalty that comes with the longer pieces and the chance to sit with something or take a deeper dive into a topic that you're looking for. I always think that, like, what do I, as a news consumer, what am I drawn to? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think the Journal knew its audience very well, right? It was, everything was the business of. So it wasn't like, when I was writing, I always thought about, you know, the business of fashion or the business of beauty, how people spend their money and their time. You know, I mean, thinking about all of this through a lens of consumer behavior was really fascinating because it's like, why do you shop where you shop? How do you shop? When do you shop? I mean, all these questions that I felt like I, as a consumer, wanted to know. It was really such a wonderful opportunity to report that out and hopefully write stories that helped people become better shoppers. I love that. You know, I mean, obviously fashion is beautiful clothes and we all love to look at it. But I think that the business aspect of it, how you're building something to sell to people, Hill was where I kind of fell in love with it.
Absolutely. That's awesome. And but you decided to leave in early 2017. Why did you end up deciding to leave? What was the next step for you?
So life in sort of the end of 2016 and 2017 got kind of interesting for me. I had been at the paper for more than a decade. I had written a lot of stories I was really proud of, and I was kind of wondering what was next. Like, what did I want to do? And a lot of journalists at that point sort of explore an editing career. And that wasn't particularly interesting for me. I felt like there was still some writing I wanted to do and still some stories that I thought I could tell. But at the same time, the paper was kind of shifting its priorities, and some of the feature sections that they had invested in, they closed down, and I was on part of that team. And so the coverage it didn't feel like it was the same. You know, I mean, it didn't have I used to write for the personal journal section, and that is no longer a section of the paper. And so there were a lot of things happening there. And then my husband was offered a promotion with his current job, but that would require us to move to California. And so it was this sort of confluence of events of like, okay, I'm looking for something new. I feel like there's more I can do. And like, hey, there's this great job waiting for us in the Bay Area. And I was pregnant with our second son at the time. And we thought like, okay, like if we're going to try this, let's try it. And so we moved from New York to the Bay Area. And I decided to try my hand at freelancing, which is a whole different game. Because when you're a staff writer at a place, you get paid no matter how much you write. But the world of freelance journalism is mostly paid by the word or just sort of a flat fee for a story. And so suddenly my income was tied directly to how much I was producing. So that was a real wake-up call.
Yeah, that it would seem that you'd almost go back to your days on the daily grind on the newsbeat desk, right? Just churning out as much as you can because you're trying to, you know, increase your earnings. But not only that, you have to find the relationships, cultivate them, you know, because all of a sudden you're not only a writer, you're also head of business development as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was I was really lucky because I had worked in the business for so long and I had a lot of contacts. And the minute I said that I was going to try freelance, I had a lot of editors reach out, which is wonderful and was a great place to start. I learned pretty quickly the importance of not just your income, but your like having your name out there, right? So there's some things that you could write pretty quickly that wouldn't pay a lot, but that would just sort of keep you top of mind for people. And then that would sort of get you kind of the longer pieces for a print publication, that the rate per word was much higher. And so it was figuring that out to start. I, at the beginning, decided I was going to write for anybody that asked just once, just to see what it was like. Because it was kind of thrilling, I have to say. Like the journal, I'm sure you read it, it's a very specific tone and a very specific sort of style. And I had gotten very good at that formula. I knew how to write a Wall Street Journal story, and I knew, you know, like I knew what pieces were required. I knew the tone, I knew the length, I knew all of that stuff. But suddenly I was writing for all different kinds of places, and there were people that were encouraging me to use my voice in new ways, and people that, you know, wanted longer pieces and, you know, exploring different kinds of sources and things like that. And so I thought, you know, for this first year that I do this, I'm just going to try it and see what happens. And I learned a lot about what I like and what I wanted to pursue so I could focus a little bit more going forward.
That's really cool. It's interesting, after spending a decade at a place and getting very comfortable, very few people are willing to take that leap and try something new because you get so comfortable with doing things a certain way. And it takes a lot of guts to be able to say, you know what, like, let's try doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's funny. When I left the journal, I had been there over a decade, and I was one of the short-term people that left. A lot of people left around the same time I did because of the changes at the paper. And people who had been there for like 20 years, 30 years, you know, the Wall Street Journal is a place you tend to go and stay because it's very scary to think about what you are without that. I mean, my handle on Twitter, Instagram was eHolmesWSJ for
It was part of your identity.
It was. And people knew me as such. And it's funny today because some people still very much associate me with the journal, but a lot of my new followers just know me as me, kind of thing. And I thought, like, how could I possibly drop the WSJ? I was Elizabeth Holmes from the Wall Street Journal for so, so long. And it was so scary to think of not having that. There's that famous David Carr from the New York Times. He wrote a column about, like, when you leave the New York Times, you like take off the bat suit, And, you know, you give the bat suit to the next person, like that it doesn't, yeah. You don't get to take the bat suit with you. And I kept thinking about mm-hmm. that, like, what am I going to be without it? And it was scary. It was for sure. It felt like a big jump.
Oh, 100%. I can 100% appreciate that, especially as a journalist. There's a certain level of clout that being at a publication like that gives you. And so when you no longer have that, you almost feel naked in a sense. And okay, I got to redefine myself. But you dove right in. I think that's really impressive. And I think that it also probably is the reason why you created what you've created in SMT. Because you're willing to try new things. You're a traditional journalist, right? You have all of the training. You sat in front of a camera and did it on air. You did the local beat. You've done the thing at the massive international publication like the Wall Street Journal. And you've not been afraid to embrace new mediums, which is really impressive when you think about it in the context of what most of us do for our lives. We focus on one thing, get really good at that, and just keep pounding away. But let's dive into SMT. How did it all come about? Tell us a little bit about how you decided that Instagram stories was going to be the medium for a person who has for a long time been a long form journalist.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to say it was really strategic and I like sort of plotted this out, but it was not. I'll back up and say that social media was something that was always really interesting to me. I wrote, I think, one of, if not the first story on Instagram for the Wall Street Journal. And the headline was something like, iPhone app is popular at Fashion Week. I called up Kevin. I'm not even joking. I just emailed Kevin, Instagram founder. I mean, this was long before Facebook bought them for $1 billion.
That is incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember I requested an iPhone so that I could use Instagram because that's how it was first. I had a BlackBerry, I think, when this all started. Constantly looking for ways to write about Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and other social media platforms at the Journal as part of my style beat. And I loved using them myself because I learned so much and I met so many cool people. Like this was a long time ago, but I did a piece on Erica Behrman over at Oscar de la Renta when she was Oscar PR girl. Yeah, she was. Yeah. I did like the big debut piece on her, and we did like a cover story, and it was the day of their fashion show.
she's like the OG influencer.
Her and like Aliza Licht, who is a DKNY. I mean, there was the whole group of us. Yeah, and like I wrote that Erica Oscar story, and Anna Wintour supposedly said to Erica, like, I saw your story in the Journal, but it was long before Erica was like the famous influencer that she was. It was like back when it was just sort of a novel thing to have a human voice at sort of a fashion luxury brand like that.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my first stories at the Journal was on MySpace and how advertisers were using MySpace. So that, mm-hmm. that definitely confirms my age. But social media was very interesting to me and has always been something that I've wanted to report on and use myself. So at the Journal, it was sort of an interesting place in terms of social media and personal brands, because at the Journal, you are there servicing the Journal, right? Like the brand is the Wall Street Journal. And this was before reporters were sort of known as entities themselves and things like that. And I was always kind of pushing the boundary a little bit, trying to come up with a voice and create my own audience. And that was always something that was really interesting to me, because I felt like a lot, especially of young women who followed me, were probably new to the Journal. And I heard from a lot of them that they would like subscribe to the Journal so they could read my story. So I knew there was a base of engaged, enthusiastic women looking for smart content. And that's always sort of the audience I've had in mind as I push stuff out. And, at the Journal, it was in the early days, it was like, can you just tweet links to your stories? And I was like, no, nobody wants to just read links. They have to know me as a person. And then when I write something, then it's like, oh, my friend Elizabeth wrote something. Of course I want to read it, kind of thing. And so have that human connection.
That's really, really interesting that you took that perspective so early on. And I think what fascinates me about this is there's so many people who opine on subjects where they're not actually engaged and they're not actually embedded. And I think social media is one of those things that you have to really embed yourself in, because there are different subcultures for each of these different platforms. And you clearly embrace that, and you embrace the idea that, hey, for me to be successful as a journalist, not only do I have to have kind of the brand being associated with the Wall Street Journal, but people have to like me and know me separately from that as well, in order for me to get them to read my stuff. That's really prescient, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of what I learned all of this as I was writing about it, because, you know, just like Erica was doing at Oscar, she was making that brand human. And so my own brand had to be human too, you know what I mean? And I think especially coming from a place like the Wall Street Journal, people can be a little like, oh, I don't know that I want to read a Wall Street Journal story on that kind of thing. And especially back, I mean, many years ago, before it sort of expanded all of its wonderful fashion coverage that it has now, it was sort of still like it was not thought of, right, in the same way as some more accessible style publications. And so I felt like I had to 100%. Do some work to make people think like, oh, that's a story I want to read. And I also just loved hearing from people. You know, you have a direct line to your audience, and people, especially I feel like in the early days, they weren't necessarily shy about telling you what they thought. And so it was just, it was true, you know, I mean, as a reporter, you always hear from people in some form or another, but this felt like a very direct way to hear from readers too. And so I saw it as a real opportunity. And listen, like at the Journal, it was a little push and pull sometimes. Sometimes I was being told, you know, like there was definitely this sense of like, how do we use social media in a way that's appropriate to the Wall Street Journal brand? And so that was also something I was constantly thinking of. There were a lot of rules about what you could say and couldn't say. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that that's sort of how I was introduced to social media, because it gave me a good kind of framework, you know, like to not just say every single thing that I'm thinking, because there was somebody reading my tweet somewhere, you know, I mean, that was a really important thing. But when I left the Journal, I did feel like, oh, I can have a little bit more fun here. I can experiment a little bit more. I can try some new things. And so fast forward to the start of SMT, I left the Journal. I had had a second child. I was trying to take a little bit of a maternity leave, and I was spending a lot of time on my phone. I mean, I think anybody who's had a baby and has to nurse that baby at all hours of the day spends a lot of time on their phone. And I became a real admirer of what folks were doing on Instagram stories, because Instagram has always been my favorite platform. And I kind of was intrigued when Instagram stories start at the way that you could, the stakes felt lower, right? My feed had always been kind of a precious place, and I had wanted to post only pretty photos and be really careful and think about those pictures and the captions and things like that. But suddenly stories felt like a place to kind of like loosen up a little and have a little bit more fun.
Let your hair down. Yeah.
You know, have a drink.
That's right.
And, you know, tap on some fun. And I had really also like, I love that you could do kind of different things, like the progressive storytelling that you could, you know, post one thing and then post it again with something else on the slide and, you know, like build on it that way. I felt like there were some people that were doing cool things there. And so, I mean, this is, again, like the origin story of SMT is so not strategic. It's just that I happened to see one day in December, I saw the Kate and Will holiday card portrait pop up in my feed. It was, you know, the Cambridges smiling up at me. And I thought to myself, I have so many thoughts about this. And I screenshotted it. I wrote so many thoughts across the bottom and I uploaded it. And then I did it again and I added a couple text bubbles. And then I did it again and I added a like, but mostly takeaway. And I was just, you know, I'm somebody who's always been interested in the Royals. I've always kind of found them fascinating. I got married the same year that Kate and Will got married, and I've just always sort of had that bug, and people just went nuts. I don't think I had ever actually DM'd anybody on Instagram before. And suddenly I had all these messages from people that were like, oh my gosh, I love this. It's so funny. And I was like, oh, hey, like there are other people that want to talk about this too, because I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
And so a couple days later, Harry and Meghan released their engagement portraits, and Meghan was wearing that like fabulous Ralph and Russo gown. And like, it was just, I was like, I have so many thoughts again. So I did it again and I got the same response. And I just was blown away that there were these people out there, some people I had known and some people, you know, who were strangers. I had a pretty decent following at this point. And I was like, oh, hey, you are my people. Let's do this. And so I just kept weighing in. I mean, there were so many. The nice thing about the Royals is that they make regular appearances. So there were a lot of opportunities to try this out and test it. And it was building to May 2018, which was Harry and Meghan's wedding. And I felt like I just kept doing it and people kept liking it. And it started off as a very kind of like picking
energy. I didn't understand it, but they just kept liking it.
I know. I was like, oh, like this is so great. And it started off as like kind of just me trying to be like funny and entertaining and clever and like,
sure.
If you like some of the early ones I read and I totally cringe because I'm like, like that wasn't really, they're not particularly insightful, but it was, yeah. It was the kind of thing that I, the more I did it, the more I learned what people were responding to and that I was sort of uniquely positioned to weigh in on this stuff because I had spent so long at the Journal reporting on the business of fashion, on marketing and messaging and what the power of clothing, what it can say. And suddenly I was able to kind of decode for people what the royal fashion choices meant. And I just mm-hmm. hit on this yeah. thing and people loved it and I loved doing it.
Now I gotta ask, do you think that the royals put as much thought into what they wear as you do into dissecting it?
Okay. That's a very fair question. That's a very fair question. So I'll back up and say, like, when I started this, I was more commenting on my personal thoughts on their fashion, you know, less about what I thought they were trying to say and more about whether I thought it was appropriate or not.
I guess I'm jumping the gun here because we haven't even gotten to the good part yet.
No, it's okay. No, it's like kind of the evolution of SMT, which I've actually thought about a lot lately because I've read some of those early ones and it's just me thinking like, is this a good outfit or no? You know? And I mean, I think there's a lot of people that can do that. And I think everybody can do that, right? Everybody can make a snap opinion.
Sure.
On
because it's subjective. You have a little bit more of authority though, given what you've done for 10 plus years.
Yeah. I mean, but I was able to say like, whether I thought this was a good outfit or not kind of thing. And like people thought it was mm-hmm. funny and it was a great, and you know, obviously in the royal world, there's just a lot of gushing. And so like the better the outfit, the more gushing there was kind of thing. So then as SMT was picking up steam and I was looking into more royal history and understanding royal fashion, and also as being like sort of a longtime admirer and reader of other fashion critics, like Vanessa Friedman at the New York Times, Robin Gavon at the Washington Post. I mean, these are people who understand the meaning of clothes. And those have always been the stories of theirs that I've gravitated to first because I find that fascinating. And the more I learned about royal women, the more that I understood is that they know they have a worldwide platform and they know that their choices are dissected immediately. I mean, there's an army of style bloggers that are fantastic at the minute Kate or Meghan steps out that they can ID whatever they're wearing. So fast. I mean, it's a real skill.
That's so
and that
crazy
is not what
me.
I do. I know that's not yeah. what I do, but they have a team of, you know, stylists and they do all these like Google image searches and they can figure stuff out so quickly. And these royal women know that and they know they have an opportunity because I think what maybe people don't understand is that royals don't give interviews. You know, I mean, they don't by and large, I mean, they do every now and then, but they don't sit down and tell all. They don't give these speeches where they're revealing their personal preferences. Their whole point is to make appearances and sort of spread, you know, the goodwill of the United Kingdom. And so they are there to be seen and to be photographed. And whether you think that's fair or not, which that's a very valid discussion to have, that's what's happened. That's sort of the state of things, that their appearances are dissected. And so I think what they've done is they recognize that and they use it to their advantage. They use it to send a message. Now, is every single detail meant to send a message? No, I don't think so. But I think the introduction of Meghan on the scene in particular really stepped up the game on this for everybody because Meghan came from a costume designer background, right? She was on Suits, on some other shows, mm-hmm. and she had a chance yep. to work with, and if there's anybody that sends a message or tells a story, it's costume designers. I mean, that's their whole sure. job. You know, I mean, they are fantastic at this. And those are the people I actually love to talk to most rather than say even a stylist, because a costume designer is telling a story with clothes. And Meghan, you know, she gave interviews where she talks about her, you know, Rachel Zane and her wardrobe on suits and the messages they were trying to send. And so the minute Meghan hit the royal scene, she was doing this. You know, I mean, it took Kate Middleton a little bit of a like an adjustment period, I think, until she got better and more sort of savvy and sophisticated with her clothes. But Meghan jumped right in. And you can see, you know, when she goes to an event for International Women's Day and she's wearing all small female founded brands, that's not an accident. You know, I mean, she does that very much on purpose. And I think that's really smart. And I think that that should be celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's really, really fascinating. And, you know, it's interesting because not now this has gone from, hey, this is, I've grown a massive following on Instagram that's just waiting for me to put this out. But now you're writing a book about this.
So this is kind of like a dream come true. I mean, again, I didn't script any of this, but to go from being like a journalist to a royal commentator to now an author is really a thrill. And I think, listen, every journalist wants to write a book. And if they say they don't, they're lying, because I think everybody feels like they have a book in them. But I wanted this to be the right book at the right time and to come from a place that sort of was in the spirit of what I do on Instagram, but worthy of a book. You know, it's a very different sort of experience to sit with something or have something in your home on a coffee table versus, you know, catching it on the fly on your phone. So that was kind of exciting. But HRH, So Many Thoughts on Royal Style, is looking not just at Kate and Meghan, but at the Queen and Diana. And what I've learned from all of this research is how much Kate and Meghan are taking a page from the women that came before them. And it's so fun to see the connections between the four and to just enjoy royal style. I mean, I think now more than ever, we need that kind of escape to look at these beautiful women in beautiful clothes.
Certainly. Yeah. And so can you talk a little bit more about what the process has been like? I've obviously seen that you've solicited your followers' help in many ways, you know, just like on the brainstorming front this, you know, last year when you kind of started in the process. Talk to us a little bit about the process, given that it is so unique. It's not a traditional kind of journalistic journey.
Yeah. So I'll back up a little bit further. And my lesson for folks is when you know you want to do something, don't be afraid to wait for the right time. Because back, I guess, in, here are we even, I don't even, I'm like, this is 2020. So late 2018. So I had had a nice pop with Harry and Meghan's wedding, but then SMT really took off in the fall of 2018 with their tour of Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, and Tonga. Because it was a 16-day thing. Meghan wore like 30 plus outfits. I mean, I was SMTing all the time. It really, that's when I saw like a huge pop and people suddenly got really excited about what I was doing and what So Many Thoughts was all about. And that tour was really, I mean, there was a lot to talk about there. So that fall, a publisher approached me about doing a book. And I had an agent at that time because I had sort of toyed with the idea of a different kind of book. And so I went to him and I, you know, we talked about it and I talked to this publisher about the book and they kind of outlined some parameters and they made me an offer and it didn't feel right. It just wasn't right. And everybody was like, no, this is good. Like this, you get to write a book about this. Like, yes, you should say yes to this. And I was like, it just does not feel big enough. It does not feel like everybody involved recognizes the potential here. I mean, SMT was like a year old. I felt like I didn't, you know, I didn't have a website. I didn't have much of anything. And they were like, no, you should take this deal. And I was like, I'm not taking this deal. I'm going to say no. And it was so hard because I really, you know, it was hard. I thought like, am I walking away from my chance to write a book on the royals? Well, jump cut a couple weeks later, somebody I had known for a long time reached out in my DMs, Kate Childs, who's now my agent at CAA. And she was like, hey, I'm going to be in town. Do you want to like grab a meal? And I was like, I would love to. And Kate is wonderful. And that meal changed everything. I mean, we got pizza and we just sort of outlined the potential for SMT and what I was building, that it was more than just a book. You know, I mean, that there was a real community here. And Kate's idea to kind of work on some bigger things, to launch a website, to, you know, launch a newsletter. And then the big thing was a year ago, I had a meetup in New York and God, I long for those days. I think about it now, like so fondly, especially. But she said, you know, let's see if we can get a bunch of your fans together and like have a Q&A. Like, let's just see what it would be like to get everybody together. And so we did that, and the tickets, it was like 250 tickets sold out in like 20 minutes. I mean, it went so fast, and we packed this room full of all these women wearing, you know, bows and headbands. And I did a Q&A with Joanna from Cup of Joe, and we invited a bunch of publishers, and just to see, to be in that room, to feel what, you know, I was feeling all along in my DMs and with my online community, but to get everybody to come out and be together for a night was amazing. And it's something I'll never forget.
That's really interesting.
Yes, it showed me that people are so hungry for an IRL experience. I mean, it's crazy to me how positive and sort of energetic the crowd was. I mean, people were just so thrilled to find other royal fans, to find, you know, like smart, enthusiastic women. You know, I mean, it was just like everybody was being really kind to one another. I heard from several people afterwards that were like, I went by myself because I didn't have any, you know, like I just moved to New York, or I didn't have anyone to come with me, and I made a friend. And like, it was this amazing sort of meetup of this SMT fam that I call it. And it was wonderful. It was so wonderful for me. It was wonderful for SMT. And then it was wonderful for the book, because I very quickly after that put together a new proposal, came back to New York, took a bunch of meetings, had a very exciting book auction, and decided to go with Celadon, my publisher, in a deal that was much bigger than the one I had turned down
sure.
in December.
Yeah.
And yeah. you just don't know, right? I mean, saying no is so yeah. hard, but it was the best thing I could have done.
But I also think it's fascinating, because reading is generally a solitary thing in terms of how we think about it. And you think about the experience and then the distribution required, and you think, okay, well, how is an IRL experience really going to matter in this whole thing? But I think that your friend at CAA, what did you say her name was?
Kate Child. She's fantastic.
Kate Child. She's now yeah. your agent.
Yeah.
Like, understood what the book agents and publishers needed to feel in order to really get behind a project like this. And I think that's so fascinating, because you take what is a very solitary type of endeavor, reading and writing, and bringing it together and bringing people together and creating that electricity and the impact that it can have, not only on the publishers, but even on yourself, right? And understanding how big it could be, and finally wrapping your hands around, okay, I kind of understand what this could really be.
Yes, it was very eye-opening to me, because it was one of those things that, again, it wasn't like super strategic, and that I was like, oh, I have to be on the East Coast for a story. I was writing a cover story for Town and Country, and I was going to Boston, and I was like, I can easily dip down to New York. Like, can we throw something together? And Kate mm-hmm. was like, this is, yes, we will absolutely do this. And we found the space, and we did the tickets, and we, you know, like got somebody to donate some wine, and got like some fantastic folks at Sally Hansen and Scutchy to donate some bows for a gift bag. And then I like ordered cardboard cutouts of Kate and Megan to like put together like a photo opportunity yeah. that I could, I mean, it was very scrappy. And just to see it all play out, and to get those people together in a room, and to see everybody be so excited just to be with one another, just because this idea of talking about the royal women and talking about fashion and the power of fashion and smart fashion, it was so exciting for me, and I feel like for the rest of the audience. And it showed all of these publishers that were there and that came, like, oh, this is not like just a funny little thing she's doing on Instagram. Like, this is really something, and people are really excited about it, and they're excited to talk about it with her and with their friends. And like, it just made it so much bigger. And that's yeah, what we needed.
That's really cool. Yeah. And
great.
So how have you brought your followers into the process?
So the book was a kind of a crazy thing. And this is like, I don't know what percentage of your audience is women and or women with children, or thinking about having children.
There's a healthy percentage of women. Yeah.
So I did all of this while I was pregnant with our third. And
wow.
I like the event was when I was, the event, I was like 5 or 6 months pregnant. I sold the book at 7 months pregnant. I came back to New York and took all these meetings. And that was really an empowering thing to sell a book while that pregnant with my third. And I thought, you know, this is my third. I've been through this before. I know what to expect. Like, I got this. And the publisher that I went with, Celadon, felt very strongly that this book, we had initially thought of it as a spring 2021 kind of gifting moment. And my publisher said, we love this. We love this book. We want to work on it with you, but we really feel like it's a holiday 2020 play. Like, for, you know, this is a great book that people are going to want to give to their friends and family. Plus, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the fall of 2020. People are going to want some good news. They're going to want something that's fun to think about. And I was like, yes, for sure. Like, I can, you know, I mean, this is like, this is the spring of 2019. I'm like, yeah, oh, no problem. They're like, so we need you to file, because books take forever. We need you to file a book by the end of the year. And I was like, totally. I will file a book to you by the end of this year.
Yeah, not and have a really baby and thinking. Make sure my two existing children stay alive. No problem.
I mean, it was really, I'm not sure I would ever recommend anybody do what I did, but it felt great in the moment. It felt really great. And so I hired some researchers between when I signed the book deal and before I had the baby to like do some deep dives into each of these women and come up with some real robust briefs that could serve as sort of my jumping off point. And then I had a baby in August, and 3 weeks later was like, I should start writing a book now. And I did with my third. It was crazy. And again, I don't know that I would recommend it, but I was sort of committed to cranking it out as quickly as possible. It also coincided with two pretty big royal tours, which in the royal following world are big deals and require a lot of SMT. And so I kind of really dove back in. And where possible, I did ask, you know, my followers what they wanted to see from it. It was, I mean, last fall was just a blur. I think writing a book is really hard. If you think of a regular Wall Street Journal story as like 1,000 words, maybe 1,500, a regular magazine cover story is like 2,000 words. A book is like 60,000 words. So you're writing a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. And I also, we sold this book as very much a hybrid between a regular book and a coffee table book. So it's both a full words book and has like 350 photos in it.
Wow.
Because everybody wants to see these really beautiful women in these really beautiful books. And so it was a lot. And I did not file it by the end of the year. Spoiler alert. I did file it a couple weeks late, but that's also what happens in books.
I don't think anybody's going to hold that against you.
And then, you know, I mean, and then I think I didn't understand this before I went into writing a book. There's just a lot of stages to writing a book. So you have to write it, and then you have to revise it, and then you have to fact check it. And then, yeah, I mean, I was staring at these pictures of Kate in tiaras, and I was like, I can't decide. And I put it to my Instagram followers, and they were like, number one was like, it was between number one and number two. And it was so clear to them that I was like, yes, okay, yes, I'm going to go with what you thought. So I tried to bring people into this book process. It's hard to find the mental sort of bandwidth to share it all as I'm doing it. And
of course, you know,
sort of in the trenches of it. But this is very much the book that Instagram built. And I'm so thankful to my followers for supporting it, for sure.
So Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about the recent reveal of the cover. Tell us about what's going on. And also, I definitely want to talk about Beatrice's wedding, because it's very much related to the book in many ways.
Well, I am so excited about the response to the book, because this is something that I have been working on for a long time. And I've been working on, you know, sort of in my own little corner of the world out here. And to finally be able to share a taste of it, a big taste of it, with the cover was so exciting, and the response to it, because books, I had always wondered, like, why does a book take so long? You know, I mean, as a journalist, especially a newspaper journalist, I was used to writing something, it would go in the paper the next day. Even for magazines, you write something, and then, you know, a month or two later, it shows up on the newsstand.
Right, right.
Books really do take a long time, and there are many, many stages to it. And I've learned them all at this point. But I started writing it about three and a half weeks after my third daughter was born, my third child, and have been sort of in this like frantic mode to like get it all on the page and to select all the pictures and do all these things. And so it's so exciting to see it come to life. The book comes out in November, and to ask for pre-orders in July is also a little different, right? Because people are like, wait a minute, November's like months and months away.
But it's super important.
Super important. So this is not just about my book, but for any book, if you want to support that author, buy that book early. Because what it does is publishers watch all those numbers come in and they decide how much marketing they're going to put behind it, how much they're going to sort of push it in the press, how many copies they're going to print. It's a really big deal. And so ordering a book that early tells a publisher like, hey, I'm very interested in this author and what he or she has to say. And so I tried when we released the HRH cover to kind of explain all of that to my followers. And I was so, so heartened by their response, because I think people really do get it and want to support me. But more than that, they want a beautiful book of royal photos in their home come November, and give it as a gift in the holidays too. So it was, it was really exciting. We released a cover and then we did a pre-order campaign with it, which my publisher ran. And I was so grateful that they were willing to invest in that, because it sort of gives people a nice little extra incentive to buy the book early. And so we had for the first 2 weeks between the first 2 weeks after the cover reveal, we said, hey, if you upload your receipt here, you'll get a free surprise gift, which I can't say what it is, but coming before the book comes out. And so, you know, book promotion, because it lasts so long, you want to create these little moments around it, right? So it was fun to see it really pop around the cover reveal. And then hopefully when the gifts are mailed in a couple months, we'll have another moment there. And then certainly around pub date. So it's all about getting people excited, but not kind of overdoing it with talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, which is hard to do, right?
Yeah, it is. It's really hard. And for me, I kept being like, are you sure we have to share the cover now? Like, it's July. And they were like, wait, this is like the last moment we can, because we have to decide. They have to place, you know, they have to book the slot in the printing machines to make sure that they have enough. You know, I mean, it's like very important to do it early. And so this is for any author. If you see any book that's for sale ahead of time, it really helps if you buy it early.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And walk us through the how you guys worked on the cover. Right? How do you choose? Because you obviously, just to cull down the number of images in the book alone, but then to figure out what the cover is going to look like, what images you use there. What was that process like?
Well, so the book, it's funny because a lot of people have asked me, like, is this like SMT the book? And it's not. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not pages with my little text bubbles on top of it. I was very, very sort of aware that when I was doing this book, that I wanted it to be a book, a beautiful book in your home, right? Because the experience of sitting down on your sofa and picking it up off your coffee table is very different than like on the fly looking at, you know, what I have to say on Instagram. And so we wanted to make sure that the cover was sort of a very visual representation of that, but then also, you know, was familiar for people who know what I do on Instagram. And so I was so lucky. They let me bring in a designer that I've really known and respected for a long time, Elizabeth Olson. And she's done some beautiful book covers. And we just talked about it. I mean, for months, this went on for months. I don't know what this sort of standard book cover process is for people, because this is my first time doing it. But picking out the photos, because obviously there's not a photo of all four of these women together. And so we needed four individual shots that worked in concert with one another. I also wanted it to feel kind of reminiscent of, this is, I'll give you one little chocolate chip here, the Instagram grid. In a way. So the four photos, the way that they kind of come together, are meant to sort of hint at that. And then, you know, the color was a huge part of it too, because if you think of a book as something you want to sit down and read, or if you think of a book as something you want to display in your home, you know, I wanted this to be both. And I wanted it to stand out on shelves. I wanted it to do a lot of things, and coming up with kind of a unique color. If you start looking at all the books around your house, there are a lot of different colors and a lot of really beautiful colors for books. And I think this is just sort of my creative way. I kind of look at everything. We sort of played around with every different iteration of it. And I'm so thrilled with the HRH blue that we picked, because it does feel like it has a little bit of a princess feel to it, but it's not pink. It's not going too far, right? Like it's calming, and I think it's beautiful, and I think it will fit in really nicely in people's homes too.
Absolutely. And also tell us a little bit about the audience here, because you have a very diehard royal audience, right? And they plug into everything related to the royals. But you're also obviously going to be targeting folks who are maybe just more tangentially interested, who aren't following your account, hanging on to every SMT word that you put out. How do you think about that? How do you talk about that with the publishers? And then think about that vis-a-vis marketing as well.
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of this. So, I mean, I have a sizable audience on Instagram, but I'm by no means a big influencer. And I think I'm thrilled at the response of my community to it, but we want this book to appeal to a much wider royal audience, right? We want this book to appeal to people who are fans of the royal family. And listen, that's a huge that's a huge segment of the population. And it has a nice sort of cross-generational appeal to it too. I think that this is a gift that a lot of people will give their mothers or give to their daughters or their aunts or their sisters, kind of thing. And so we definitely saw this as a gifting book, which is why originally we had, I had in the original proposal for the book, we saw this as sort of a spring 2021 play, and the publisher that I went with felt really strongly that it needed to be holiday 2020, that this is something that people would want to give to one another. Another reason why I wanted the cover to be beautiful, I wanted to just put a bow on it. You can tie a bow right across the middle and put it under your tree or give it at a right. holiday party if we ever have those. So we're very much thinking about this book, not just as something that will appeal to sort of the very intense and enthusiastic online royal circles, of which there are many and I'm proud to be a part of, but I think... I've heard from a lot of people, and this is truly the highest compliment, that they pre-ordered not one, but two copies because they're planning to keep one for themselves and give it to a friend. And so book sales are all about sort of inspiring people to want to talk about it on your behalf. And there's no higher compliment than saying, I picked up this for my friend. You know what I mean? I think that's a really wonderful thing as an author to hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you've also been blessed with some natural PR, some natural talking points. Obviously, there was a royal wedding just a week and a half ago at this point. And you have the very dress that she was wearing is actually in your book already. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So there's a fun thing that happens is whenever I see any photo of Kate or Meghan on Instagram now, I do this thing in my head where I'm like in the book or out of the book, you know, like did it make the cut?
Yeah. You're going back into that catalog you have
like
in your head.
All those photos. It's ongoing. And so it's really fun actually, because there's some people, especially with fan accounts, like one of my, the fan accounts of Meghan's that I follow really closely. She posted a photo of a Meghan that was in the dress and I wanted to be like, it's in the book. Like, because it's so exciting. And there are obviously dozens upon dozens of outfits for all of these women in the book. And so when Princess Beatrice's wedding pictures were released, like, gosh, what a fun moment that was. I think we were all just like, just thrilled and delighted to think about something happy, especially out of the royal family, who has had sort of a turbulent year. And it was so amazing to see her not only in Queen Mary's French tiara that the Queen had worn on her wedding day, but also this amazing Norman Hartnell dress, the gown really, that she had reworked. And I immediately was like, it's in the book. I know exactly where it is. It's on the page. It's like the book is sort of oriented around spreads. And so you open it up and each spread has kind of a theme about it. And it works through each woman's life kind of chronologically. And I wanted to explain the opening of Parliament, the state opening of Parliament, which is a big occasion for the Queen, where she wears, it's one of the, you know, very few times actually in the year she wears a crown. And I flipped right to that page and I was like, there it is on the Queen. And to see it in present day on Princess Beatrice for her wedding day, no less, was really thrilling. And those sorts of moments, I think royal fans, regardless of sort of your, how deep you've gone into it, there are a lot of things when you're flipping through HRH that I think will sort of jump out. And then throughout the book are sort of sprinkled these kind of moments where I think the women are extremely interconnected in their fashion strategies. And that was actually really fun too, to see a spread of Diana's sequin gowns and put in a Meghan picture too, because she had an amazing sequin gown moment. So even though each woman in this book gets sort of her own section and her own do, I think the overlap between them is really exciting too.
Absolutely. No, and it's fun to kind of see it happening before your very eyes and have nice little touch points to talk about it in a very organic way. And you have such a fervent audience as well. It's got to be fun to engage in those moments even before the book has come out and give you a reason to kind of continue to talk about it and look forward to it.
Yes. And because the book is still a work in progress, and this is another, like, I don't know if it's a shortcoming of me as a writer, but I'm working on it until the very, very last minute. But I happened to be working on the book when Princess Beatrice's pictures came out, and I immediately went to that page and I switched the caption to make sure that I couldn't add the Princess Beatrice photo in there, but I could mention in the caption of the queen in that dress that Princess Beatrice had worn it. And so I am looking for ways to make it as current as possible up until the very last minute. One of my mentors from the Wall Street Journal used to say, you work until the drawbridge comes up. And I'm like hanging onto that drawbridge. It's going up and I'm like swinging from it. But yeah, no, it's fun to see all this kind of play out.
Absolutely. No, that's wonderful. And, you know, it's been such a labor of love for you. It's also been such an interesting path because you came from, I mean, you originally started your career on camera. You moved to New York, finally, Wall Street Journal, focused on fashion for a while, did a bunch of different things. And here you are, a traditional journalist, you know, using Instagram stories as your medium. And then that morphs into this book that is not going to be a shot for shot replication of your thought bubbles over photos. But, you know, in many ways, it's a kind of a literary representation of that, a more traditional literary representation of that. It's such an interesting path and winding path. Like, tell us your thoughts around that and what advice would you have for folks who maybe are still trying to kind of find their way in this world?
Well, so something I've thought a lot about with the book and as I've talked with my publisher and the marketing department there, this is very new territory for me. So I feel like the going from a staff job at the Wall Street Journal to freelancing was sort of a shift. And then obviously going from straight journalism to royal commentary was a big shift. And this shift now with the book is not just the writing of it, which was really exciting, but also familiar to me. There was a heavy photo lift here. There are 370 photos in the book, all of which I bought. So that was my budget and my choice. And those shots were selected by me and a photo editor that I brought in to help. That was very new to me, and making sure that I was picking, you know, beautiful shots of these women and also making it make sense within my budget because these royal photos are really expensive. So that was sort of a new learning for me, and I was thrilled for that. And now with the book itself, promoting and selling something is really not something I have ever done before. And it's intimidating, I'll be honest, in a lot of ways, because as a journalist, you're writing something and you're contributing to something that is sort of packaged and delivered, right? If you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, it, you know, shows up on your doorstep, or you know, get it on your computer. If you are on TV, it just shows up on your TV. There's like a lot of people involved in that process. But suddenly this is me and my book and my sort of, my thing to talk about and my thing to sell. And I think it's different, as a writer, to sit down with something and write something that you want people to buy, that you want people to buy and bring into their homes. Mm-hmm. And so very early on, I decided that HRH needed to be a celebration of these women. I think it's really important to understand that somebody who's spending, you know, the cover or the retail price is $35. If they're spending $35 on something that they're going to bring into their home, they're probably a fan of the royal family, right? Yeah. Like they have probably bought into this and they want to see beautiful pictures and sort of a celebration of them. And that's not to say there isn't, there's a very accurate, and I worked very hard to make the sort of essays that introduce each section reflect each woman and her challenges and what she faced and what she was up against and the ways in which she was wronged too. But I think on the whole, it was sort of thinking about something as who is going to buy this and what do they want from it? And that was exciting for me as a writer because It's just a different sort of mindset when you're producing something. And then in terms of my follower base, I have dabbled, as we've talked about, in a lot of different sort of revenue streams. I try, you know, I've done a little bit with affiliate links and actually really that's it. And I've done certainly my freelance journalism, but I haven't asked people to buy something from me. And so when we put the cover out there, I was really kind of worried about what pre-order numbers would look like and how people would respond and whether or not people wanted to buy something from me. And so it's been so rewarding to see that they do, to see that, yeah. you know, to see my mm-hmm. Amazon ranking shoot up. Like that was so exciting on Cover Reveal Day and a couple more times during the 2-week period. That is all really new to me. And I think for influencers who are looking to do something similar, I'm glad that I had not tried to ask people to buy something before this point, that this was my, because this book represents so much work and so much that I'm proud of about so many thoughts, that it was somebody shared something that was like, I've consumed your free content for years. The least I can do is buy your book. And I was like, thank you. That is so kind. That
and
is
by the
really
way, it's not free content, right? You I mean, are no. paying out
exactly.
of pocket. And one of the things that you need to be commended for is the way you've approached this. You've done it the right way. There's so many people out there using images without properly compensating the creator, whether that's the photographer, whether that's the influencer. One of the things that we do, obviously, at Trove is help influencers kind of protect their image, protect their content with their image monitoring service. And unfortunately, because influencers have blown up, a lot of people are just co-opting their images. And photographers have dealt with this for a long, long time. But you've gone about it the right way at great personal cost, you know. And not only that, but you're fronting the money for the images in the book.
It's a crazy investment. And like, that's something, there's definitely been some real soul searching moments over here where I'm like, I'm pouring a lot of not only like my time, but my actual dollars into this. And I have for almost 3 years at this point. And I try not to talk about it too much on my platform because I don't want people to think that I'm, you know, complaining, because this is very much my choice to do it this way. But I feel really strongly as somebody in the creative space to compensate somebody who is creating these images and, you know, hosting the website and doing the newsletter and all of that is really, it's a big, it sort of adds up in a lot of ways. Yeah. And somebody, I've had people approach me and be like, well, what are you talking about? You don't make money. And I was like, I don't like, again, like that is,
I don't know how to explain this to you.
I'm sort of like, I don't want to like open up my spreadsheet for you, but like I keep tabs on all of it and I am not. And even
it's all red.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And even with the book, I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars. And my publisher, you know, I mean, this was something we talked about when we sold the book, and it was sort of worked into my advance. And so they were aware of it, but they didn't say you need to spend X or you need to do this number of photos. This was sort of all on me. And I, even when I said, like, I think this book should have about 350 pictures, they were like, that's a lot of pictures, Elizabeth. And I was like, I know, but I really want this to be like a deeply visually satisfying book that people want to sit and look at. Yeah. And I felt like that was worth investing in. And, you know, going to Getty and getting hundreds of photos that, you know, that have the proper rights for a book, it's a really expensive thing. And mm-hmm. I want people when they see this, but I don't know that everybody can know or appreciate that. But I think a certain segment of my audience certainly does. And that means a lot.
And by the way, it's not like they're outrageously priced, because if you think about it, right, these are wonderful photos that were taken by great photographers, and they should absolutely be compensated because, you know, they're sharing a bit because of your purchase of these in the sales of the book. But if the book vastly outperforms, and a big reason for that is the commentary that you add, a big reason for that is the images, a big reason for that is, you know, your ability to promote this and cultivate an audience. But if you vastly outperform, you know, you could look at it as a very cheap investment down the road. Now, obviously up front, it is a big investment, but these folks spend their lives taking photos and they absolutely should get compensated. So that's not the issue here. The issue here is like, you're doing it the right way. You're going about it the right way. You have, and it's not just in the book process, because I would hope that every publisher would take this approach, but you also do this on your blog as well, which I think most people in the digital world don't. Most people just right click, copy, save as, and, you know, upload, and maybe some provide, you know, some credit. And that's the very least you can do. But technically, that's still image copyright theft. So
no,
and
it's a violation. It's become a big issue in the royal fan account space, too, because some of these accounts have gotten really big and have a wonderful, loyal following and have built a really important community. And then they get shut down because of licensing issues. And it's hard because, again, if you're putting all this content out there for free and you're not charging for it and you're not making money, but you're taking photos, like, it's a really hard equation, you know, for people. And I just felt strongly early on. And I think that has in some ways limited what I've done, but I'd rather do it this way and mm-hmm. do it on a maybe smaller scale and sort of proceed in good faith. Somebody got mad at me when I shared a picture when the Beatrice wedding, I had taken a picture of a printout of my book of the photo. And someone said, how could you do that? You're stealing that photo. And I was like, oh, no, let me tell you. I paid for the social media rights too, because I know how this works. Like, that was an additional cost. And this is not actually that photo, but it's a picture of a page of a photo kind of thing. Anyway, there are a lot of pictures in my, or there are pictures that I wished I could have included in my book, but I could not buy. You know what I mean? I think people don't mm-hmm. realize that all the photos of the kids that Kate takes, you can't license those and put them in a book because it's considered a promotional piece. So it's a very interesting world to wade into, and I'm glad to do so. It's overwhelming at times, but I'm glad with my choices because I feel very proud of it.
Sure. Yeah, no. And talk to us a little bit briefly about that. You often have those moments. You mentioned earlier, I can't remember exactly what you called it, but those moments where you're wondering, am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? Because there are so many months, like you said before, you're in the red, right?
Yeah.
You're buying photos for the website, you're buying photos for social media, and you're not monetizing it. So a lot of influencers out there are spending money on content and not making a lot of money in return. Tell us a little bit about those conversations you'd have with yourself and the rationale behind it and what ultimately kept you going.
I mean, this is where I feel like I really want to acknowledge my privilege, because I am married to somebody with a stable job and health insurance. And so I can have this kind of passion project and I can invest in it. And I know I'm extremely lucky to be able to do that. I think recognizing how much you have to put into something before you can see something from it was new to me as a journalist, as a staff journalist. I feel like the nice little buffer between SMT and being on staff at the Wall Street Journal was my freelance career, because it gave me that sense of hustle. Because in the freelance world, you're paid mostly by the word. And so if I wasn't writing, I wasn't making money. And there were a lot of times when I would spend too much time writing for the amount that I was getting paid. Like, I was doing those calculations in my head and I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. But it taught me to kind of hustle for a return. And then with SMT, I don't know, again, that I did it super, that I was super aware of what I was doing to start. But there was definitely a moment before I sold the book. So, yeah, I think it was in the winter, spring of 2019. So last year, a little more than a year ago, I decided, like, okay, I'm going to really try this here. I'm going to really go for it. And I spent the money to have a website made. I spent the money to start buying the pictures. I did all that work, and it doesn't feel great, to be honest with you, when you're spending a lot of money and not getting mm-hmm. things in return. It was really, it was kind of mentally hard to motivate, because at that time, I was still very much freelancing too, and I would prioritize my paid freelance work and still see sort of SMT as this side hustle hobby kind of thing. And the book kind of made it possible for me to not have to do freelance anymore. I'm looking forward to getting back to it. But the book was also an awakening to me, because I wanted to bring in people to help me with it. Not only like did I spend money on the pictures, I've hired a photo editor who is really good, really wonderful, and a good friend of mine to pick the most beautiful shots. I recognize sort of that expertise. I hired a trio of researchers to do some really meaty briefs for me that could on each of these women so that I could have sort of a jumping off point for my writing. I hired an editor, an outside editor, to work with me on, you know, making my Instagram voice into something that was familiar and fun, but also appropriate for a book. And I hired a fact checker. That was a lot of money too. You know what I mean? I brought in a lot of people in the process. This was all of my choice. And I feel really good about it. And I'm in a privileged place to be able to do that, but it just means that the book advance payments go pretty quickly.
Right.
they sort of disappear.
And so go buy that book.
So like, these are all choices I've made, and I'm so lucky to be in a position to do it. And I do see it building and paying off. I mean, listen, the pre-orders have been amazing and my publisher is thrilled. And
that's awesome.
That's so rewarding. And should I want to do another book or a different kind of book, all of that will help me sell that next project. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So like it all builds. And I think if you're an influencer that's out there, you're like, gosh, I'm putting a lot of money into this. You have to do that gut check of for when it makes sense for you. But I do think that when you see wins, like for me, it was the cover reveal, you're like, okay, this is why I'm doing it. And this is what I'm building towards. And I think you have to, as long as it feels good and you want to keep going, you should.
Yeah.
If you can.
Yeah. And you got to make sure that the business lines up with the aspirations, of course, throughout. But sometimes, you know, it's going to be slow going in the early days. And if you have a vision and you see positive responses, they might not always be in monetary form. They might be in other forms, but that keeps you going and that keeps you investing. And hopefully you can have, you know, an outcome like it seems like you're having with HRH.
I think what's really what has become very apparent to me, because I sort of operated this last year with after the birth of my baby and now the pandemic and everything, like just put out the fire that's in front of you, like finish the book, do this, you know, like do whatever I absolutely need to do now. And the book is almost done and I'm looking forward to doing more to make this business make sense, because I also do think that like to grow so many thoughts, to make it a platform where everybody feels included and safe, I want to bring in more voices and I want to be able to pay those people, right? I would never write something for free for somebody, and I would never ask somebody to write something for free for me. You know what I mean? But all of that takes money. And I do think that my audience is at a place now where I can explain, like, I'm going to be doing more of this stuff and this is why I want to do it. And like, I think people are really on board with that. I mean, I've talked, not a ton, but I feel like I've brought people in at various points in this process about building my business, and people like to know that stuff. I mean, I think they like to be included on the journey and feel like they are invested in you and your success. And so I guess I would encourage people not to like talk about it endlessly, but as you're building your business, like people want to know about your wins and what you're doing and what it's taking. Cause I think that makes you more than just someone to follow on Instagram. It makes you a person. It makes
you
that's
depth
out there. Yeah. Who's out there really working for it. And
yeah,
I think like I explained, I did something, with face masks. I really wanted to encourage people to wear face masks, and I wanted to do and sort of an affiliate campaign around it and take that affiliate revenue and match that donation. And, up to a certain point, up to $500, and then donate it to Homeboy Industries, which is a charity that Megan and Harry appeared at. And people responded so well to that. And I think it made people feel included in a way. You know, you were probably going to buy a mask anyway. Use this link. That affiliate revenue will go towards this goal. We met it. We matched it. We donated. You know, I mean, it's an exciting thing for people to be included in the journey, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. Don't just show the end, right?
Yeah.
Show the process.
Yeah. Right? People want to know what you're up to and what you're doing. And again, like it's a fine line, right? You don't want to be, I don't want to say like every time I post a picture, like this costs me money, but it's about letting people know what you're doing. And I think there are huge misconceptions out there about influencers and income and what it makes. And so it's good to remind people every now and then, because somebody said to me, well, for every follower you have, that should be a dollar you make. for your annual salary. And I was like, whoa, no, that is perhaps a goal and I'm working towards that. But like, I want to just like be really honest out there anyway. And it's not like, it's not something I'm particularly proud of that I haven't figured this piece of the puzzle out in a better way. But I think it's certainly.
But there are a lot of people out there just like you who feel the exact same way. They're, you know, everybody is at a different, you know, place in time. We had Joy Navon on the podcast a few weeks ago and she talked about it. Everybody has a different path. Everybody has a different speed. Everybody has a different breakthrough moment and they're not all the same. And that's what's beautiful about this space, right? You wouldn't call yourself a traditional influencer, but your ability to create this book in the way you have, you are influential in the Royals space. And you are also influential to other influencers. And when you share that process with people, they can understand, all right, my process is kind of like hers. Like I haven't fully figured out the monetization side, but that's such an interesting way that she approached it and turned her talents into a book deal. Like I could do that. And there's some people that's not going to be relevant for. Like, for example, I am not going to write a book on the Royals. You know, I'm probably not going to write a book, period. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, you're going to resonate with some people. You're not going to with others. And you're also going to have multiple dimensions. And I think that's really important for people to realize. And that's why sharing the process and the journey is so important and not just kind of the headlines when the book finally launches or it finally is, you know, available for pre-order.
One thing I have learned in the last couple of weeks of the pre-order campaign is how much it meant to me when other people shared it. I got this flood of people sharing the cover and saying how excited they were about it. And I tried like heck, I find Instagram to be kind of cumbersome sometimes, but to respond to every single one that I could and just express my gratitude because it meant so much that someone was willing to place what I had created in their feed and or in their stories or wherever they shared it. And it has also made me much more aware that when I am excited and support somebody, I want to share it on my platform. Because, this is a whole sort of, I hesitate to use the word game, but you need to be vocal about the stuff that you support. And I'm trying to do a better job too of just commenting on photos. I find when people comment on my photos, it means so much. And I want to comment on a lot more of my followers' photos. And I want to, when someone takes the time to send me a really nice message, to not only respond thoughtfully, but look at their feed and see who they are and see if I can, you know, say hello. And there's one that I requested to follow and she was just like, it was adorable. She was like, oh my God, no, you can't follow me. Like, I'm not cool enough. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm so excited. And she's like, I just group texted all my friends or whatever. But like having that, I mean, it's so hard to connect with every single person. But like when people are good to you, to say thank you, to reach out, to express that digital support and to do so if possible in a public way, because then everybody gets excited about it.
And yeah,
it was a really lovely, I'm trying to sort of carve out more time in my day to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if aside from buying the book, which they can do on Amazon, right, via pre-orders.
Yes. I will say, if you really care about pre-orders, this is where it gets very into the nitty-gritty. Bestseller list, weight independent bookstores heavier in some cases.
That's great.
So the pre-order campaign, I will just come right out and say that all of your pre-orders plus your first week of sales go into these bestseller lists. And once you get on a bestseller list, you are forever a best-selling author. So it means a lot. So all the orders from July through November will contribute to, you know, I don't know if I don't want to jinx it or anything, but we'll contribute to that first pop, which is huge.
Okay.
And all of these bestseller lists, there are a lot of them out there. They do their calculations differently, but on the whole, independent bookstores are weighted more heavily. So the best thing you can do for any author is to call your local bookstore and say, hey, I'd like to order this. And that puts the book on their radar and it lets them, it locks in a sale for them, which they're thrilled about. And it makes them think like, oh, if somebody in my community wants this, maybe I should order three copies, you know, two for the shelf and one for this person kind of thing. So the best thing you can do is call an independent bookstore. Amazon is great too. Amazon is always going to be probably the cheapest and the fastest. There are a lot of different ways you can order a book, but if you're trying to do the most for an author, an independent bookstore is the best.
And we're trying to do the most. So get to your independent bookstore
I did it at my local one. I was like, can I pre-order my own book? And she was, and I never told her that I pre-ordered a bunch of books from this person, but I hadn't said I was a writer or an author. And she was like, what? And I was like, yes, I have a book coming out. And it was a really nice moment.
That's awesome. That is really great. Well, how else can they support outside of, how else can our listeners support outside of buying the book?
I think follows, right? I think in our world that follower counts still matter to people and they get excited about it. And just sort of spreading the word, you know, I mean, I think what the discussion that I am trying to have on my platform about fashion and the power of fashion and how it's something that we can all embrace and use. And, you know, it's not something that's just fun and frivolous, although in a lot of ways it can be both that too. Mm-hmm. But I think, There's just some real power in that idea and that approach to fashion. And I found that my community is great at talking about it. and I love that. That's the highest compliment.
Wonderful. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Rich.
A big thank you to Elizabeth for joining us today on Influencer Business. It's always a pleasure to chat with her. If you're not already doing so, make sure you're following her at eholms on Instagram and somanythoughts.com. Those are the two places you can go to find her. Two things I wanted to mention before I let you go. First and foremost, show some depth as an influencer and a content creator. Not everything is a highlight reel. And in fact, your audience doesn't want that from you. In order to develop a real relationship with them, you got to take them through the ups and the downs. It can't just be one or the other. So make sure you're taking them along for the process, because we're all human and we can commiserate with that during the tough times and we can celebrate that during the exciting times. So make sure you're doing that. It will give you much more depth to your audience and it will allow you to create a tighter relationship with them. And the last thing I'll say is invest in the process. Sometimes, like in Elizabeth's case, you won't make a lot of money for a while, but it ultimately pays off like it has for her. You always should be checking in with yourself and making sure you're on that path to your true north, but make sure you're doing things the right way. I mean, Elizabeth has bought all of these images and the proper way. And as content creators, that should hit home. She's rewarding the people who have put in the work. So should you. And invest in yourself, invest in the long term, because that is how good outcomes are created. So with that, thank you so much for joining us today in Influencer Business. A big shout out to Pete Crimi and the team at Sound Lounge for always making us sound better over the podcast than we do in person. Thanks to ShopStyle for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. And thank you for joining us. If you made it this far, hopefully you've enjoyed something out of this podcast. So please go leave us that 5-star rating. Give us that glowing review. It certainly helps and we certainly do appreciate it. And with that, thank you for joining us this week. I'm your host, Rich Scutellari, and we'll see you next time.